Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. Kind of in new territory here when it comes to our supply chain and critical minerals, right? I think we were a little bit exposed, maybe a lot exposed when the pandemic hit, and we found our supply chain had issues. We had way too much trust in this international connection and this international supply chain and the on-demand stuff. China lately has doubled down on a threat, though, as America tries to come out of this, right? A tariff threat for critical minerals. It's not a boast because the communist country there mines, depending on what critical mineral it is, some 30 to 40% of all critical minerals in the world. And then they refine, here's the big thing, they refine from 60 to 90% of those critical minerals. America mining companies are prepared to get busy, but they face a lot of challenges. Matt Vincent joins us today, Executive Director of the Montana Mining Association, for this is going to be a full-on rundown of what we need, what America needs, and what needs to be done stateside here to ensure that we have those critical minerals to compete. The rush is back on, but this time it's a different kind of go. Although not everything is exactly working out fine, we've got to get to work so that it does work out fine when it comes to our supply of critical minerals, not just the minerals themselves, but also the processing. Now, you would think there's a lot of resources in this country and in this state, and there are, right? But there's different dynamics. China, of course, a communist country, and they don't have any restrictions, right? And they are the world's worst polluter, okay? But over the years, and I think collaborative efforts, it has taken some rubbing and some conflict to get there. But I think America's mining is probably the cleanest, amongst the cleanest in the world as well. And so there's a lot of reasons to go forward in this country, but there are also a lot of obstacles too. Matt Vincent joins us, Executive Director of the Montana Mining Association. And Matt is so immersed in this world as well. Matt, good morning. How you doing, sir?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing great. Happy to be on the call this morning.
So. Well, and maybe happy to be stationary because you've kind of been jetting around a little bit. I want to talk about that. Dr. John Medich is going to join us here, if he can, in just a little bit. An associate of yours, a colleague, Montana Tech Executive Director of the Critical Minerals Institute. And Matt, I'm going to give Tech a shout out here. We had Bob Morris on last week. They had a summit the week before, Energy and Critical Minerals Summit, and you were a part of that too. And it seems like they're stepping up in this world now, because I think there's Montana, not only Montana, but the country is behind. So kudos to them. What do you see?
I see exactly what you see. I mean, Montana Tech just hired their new chancellor, Dr. Johnny McLean, who happens to be a geologist. And, you know, just last Tuesday, he gave a convocation to an audience up at the main auditorium on campus there. And it was his first 125 days in office. He was given a synopsis of all of the people that he had talked to and the things he learned in the first 125 days in his new position. And it also marks what the 125 significance is this year is the 125th anniversary of Montana Tech, formerly originally the Montana School of Mines. And so what I think you're seeing here with a new chancellor who's obviously got a geology background and understands the roots of Montana Tech is you got this new motion to really kind of expand and reassert itself as the natural resource development school. And that includes programs like environmental engineering. I believe the second environmental engineering program ever developed at a university in the United States. Industrial hygiene, occupational safety and health, because like you said it, Tom, mining in the United States is done better, cleaner, safer than it is in, I would just say, every other jurisdiction. I mean, there's some such as Canada and Australia, I think, that are comparable. But it's not a surprise that really, in some regards, some of the more stringent and cutting edge regulations and advancements in our industry are being done right here in Montana, where we have the former School of Mines and then a lot of great engineering grads come out of Montana State University over in Bozeman. And a lot of folks maybe know, a lot of good geologists historically come out of University of Montana.
Yeah.
So, we're in a good spot. We're the treasure state, and it's for a good reason.
Well, and there's a lot of good, good and bad samples out there. We're doing it right and doing it wrong, I think, across the state. And so
we have learned from our mistakes here in Montana. I mean, I know the whole Pegasus decline and debacle where that company shut down, I believe, 5 large-scale mines, went bankrupt, and there wasn't much of a plan on how that environmental responsibility would be taken care of. And a lot of that ended up falling back onto the state of Montana and us having to spend our tax revenues from various sources in ways that we probably should. Well, that we definitely shouldn't have. That has to be on the company to clean up and maintain for however long it takes these environmental issues. But we've made a myriad of changes to the bonding requirements that you have to go through every year and then every 5 years to make sure the state doesn't get put in that position. And, oh, by the way, if you do happen to leave the state hanging, you will be designated a bad actor and put on a list that prevents you from doing any type of mining in any way, shape, or form in the state of Montana, unless and until you have made whole the state for whatever mess you left them with. So those are a couple of real good examples of how we've learned from our own mistakes. And then, you know, probably 4 or 5 years ago, 2014 was when the first major tailings dam failure took place. It was up in British Columbia. Thank God there were no losses of life in that one. But our association at that time said, we do not want that to ever happen in the state of Montana. So what do we need to do to make sure it doesn't? And Montana to this day is the only jurisdiction that has in its regulations tailings storage facility requirements. So just a couple of good examples and things that we're proud of here in the industry in Montana.
And I appreciate that. And I appreciate, you know, starting this conversation out that way, because I think there are a lot of people who want to see our resources extracted sustainably and environmentally safe, and don't recognize, I think, that the industry has moved in that direction a lot. I mean, and you credit some sharp environmental criticism for that, but I think you credit more so our representative republic for something like that. And this is why I'm so high still on our future. So Matt Vincent is with us, executive director of the Montana Mining Association. I'm going to throw this right out here and get it moving here. China dominates processing and refining. China has also tightened its export controls on some critical gallium, antimony, although Montana has some antimony going on here, some processing anyway. And then the U.S. is responding in a lot of different ways, not to exclude the Department of Defense, which is investing as well in this. So let's talk about that dynamic, Matt, and that has to be on a lot of people's minds right now. And what's the status? I mean, how far behind are we? What's it take to catch up?
Tom, I wish I had good news on this. I mean, we have been, and you know, this comes up on all of these panel discussions, and I make sure to bring it up when I'm just speaking one on to the audience, but I mean, we've been talking about this as a country for the better part of 10 years. And it hasn't been until the last couple that we've actually been doing things. And I made a statement when I was on panel discussion at the Montana Tech Energy and Critical Materials Summit a couple weeks ago. It seems like every other week I am being asked to be part of some conversation, either at state, regional, or national level on critical minerals and a lot of the things you just brought up. And I think it's time for, in the words of Elvis Presley, a little less conversation and a lot more action. We have got to start putting the rubber on the road here. We're way too far behind. And as you've already mentioned, China is exerting its stranglehold in some cases on these critical elements more and more week to week, month to month, year to year. I mean, we came out with a new critical minerals list. We have to update that every couple of years. And when I'm saying we, and it's we as a country, it's the United States Geological Survey that does the assessment of what elements are critical. We had no sooner released the draft list that China came out with a list of six more elements that they were adding to the restricted export list. And they also, that's been pretty widely covered. But the other thing that they added in language, and they did this in a previous restriction, is they've also restricted the export of technological materials necessary for the refining of critical minerals. So not only do they have the control on the end products of these elements themselves that are being developed, but let's say we wanted to go out and start building our own refineries and smelters and metallurgical facilities. Where do most of the parts and pieces come from that you need in order to put a unit like that together? You guessed it, China. So these things, it just keeps getting darker and darker, and we've got to get our act together. And I will say this, I think everybody understands that, and we are not standing still. I've seen a lot of, you've mentioned it, a lot of investments, direct investments in companies and in technologies coming out of our federal government, namely the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And we got to move on this. I mean, you can Google this, lest you think I'm being all doom and gloom here, but there's a military theorem called the Davidson window, named after a former admiral. And that window is the earliest possible point at which China is or could be expected to draw us into a conflict over Taiwan. And that date, the earliest date on that window, is January 1st, 2027. That is a little over a year away. And I'm here to tell you, without cutting a lot of corners and without everybody pulling in the same direction, I don't know how we're going to be able to say that we have a stable domestic supply of the elements we're going to need to fight and win another war or conflict in a little over a year.
From Montana, for Montana, Voices of Montana. Trying to frame this one here. I mean, I have said, you know, there's kind of a new rush is on for critical minerals. It's not a gold rush, but it's very, very critical that America really get in this game. We've noted some statistics about the dominance of other places on these critical materials, and a lot of them we need for to really compete in this fourth industrial age, as Nancy would say, with AI and quantum computing. It's going to take a lot of energy. It's going to take a lot of those critical materials. China has really a juggernaut on them. And China and the U.S. are not exactly getting along. And it's very serious now. Matt Vincent joins us here. Matt, I'm gonna take a quick call here because Skip has called in with a question about a mine in that area. Of course, you're with the Montana Mining Association, so I think that's quite appropriate. Matt, thank you for being here, and Skip, thanks for calling. You're on here on Voices.
Hey, thanks, Tom. And I like the way that you guys started your program and laid out all the general things, the whole spectrum. And sir, I have two quick questions, and my guess is you know the answers to them. And one is having to do with the Berkeley Pit. Is there any progress on the possibility of using the Berkeley Pit for any significant production of the kinds of materials that we need to be finding? And then the second has to do with what's called the Sheep Creek Mine, which is at the southwestern corner of Ravalli County. It's up right up before you go over into the Idaho border in the National Forest. And that's a mine that will also be highly productive in critical minerals. But it's in an area that's never been mined before, and it's right at the headwaters of the Bitterroot River, all those little streams that feed what's one of the most pristine streams left. Do we really have to do that? Is the question. And the way that you started your program made me feel better about it. But would you touch on those two if you know about either one of those possible sources? And thanks for coming on today. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Skip.
Thanks for the question, Skip. I guess I'll take them in order. So the Berkeley Pit, yeah, there is still a whole lot of potential and opportunity for us to be able to utilize that as a source of rare earth elements and other critical minerals, which you hear this term critical minerals. This came up in the discussion we had at Tech. If you want to be more accurate and pointed about what you're talking about, these are critical elements, individual elements that are on that periodic table of the elements. And so minerals are those individual elements bound with other mineral type chemical molecules like carbonates or oxides, sulfides. So it's more accurate to refer to these as critical elements. There are high presence. We've done a lot of testing, and Montana Tech, the Bureau of Mines and Geology, if John ends up breaking free to jump on here, he'll be able to talk a lot about what they've been working on with regard to the pit and looking at the water, the sludges, and then where you're seeing the highest concentrations of these critical elements in the pit is because that is a federal Superfund site that is being managed to meet clean water regulations. There is a major water treatment plant, a two-phase lime treatment water facility on site that has treated billions of gallons of water over the years. They've been putting that sludge back into the pit. So that's the way the process works, is they tweak the pH of that acidic water in the pit with lime, and at each stage a sludge comes out, and that sludge is a precipitate of all of the harmful metals that are in that water binding up with the lime and falling out of solution into this precipitate. Well, you can imagine if you do that continually, you are concentrating what is in the water into a solid sludge. And so there's orders of magnitude more rare earth elements in that sludge than you would find in almost all other waste streams that have been looked at. The West Virginia University has looked at this, as well as other critical minerals, the biggest one being zinc. Zinc is a critical mineral that's used in a variety of different things, from batteries to alloys, and it is about 30% of the sludge coming out of the Berkeley Pit is zinc. So we are, as an association, working with Department of Defense and a handful of our mining company members to target priority projects where we could bring supplies of critical elements to our country, primarily Department of Defense, in a short period. And the Berkeley Pit is one of those projects that is on our list.
Thank you. And maybe take a moment to explain that, because, you know, lithium, cobalt, nickel, a lot of that stuff is actually processed when we're looking for copper or silver or things like that. I mean, or do you have deposits? Do you have large deposits of nickel? Do you like we do copper?
Well, so you touch on a good point. And I think, you know, prior to this new list coming out, I would say, no, not really. I mean, there's with exceptions. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously there's exceptions to everything. You don't normally find a primary source cobalt deposit.
Yeah.
It comes as a secondary element that's found in the geology with copper, nickel, those sort of things. And so up until they came out with this new list, we only had one critical minerals mine in Montana, a primary mine, and it's the Sibanye-Stillwater Complex.
Oh, yeah.
The palladium and platinum that they are mining. And that is not only was the only primary critical minerals mine in Montana, that is the only platinum group mine in North America. We cannot replace that if that goes out of a production. And so luckily they're not at risk of that, but I know we have been asking the federal government to ensure that we can continue to mine economically and efficiently out of that. And one of the asks that still hasn't been granted is the price of palladium is down because not China, but this Russia. Time Russia
yep.
controls about 40% of the global market on palladium, and they've been manipulating that market. And so there has been an ask by all of our congressional delegation, from Senators Steve Daine and Tim Sheehy to Representative Downing in the East District and Zinke in the West, to ban Russian palladium imports. And the U.S. has not acted on that yet. We need to act on that so we can put another safety net underneath the Sibanye-Stillwater Complex. But that new critical minerals list included copper and silver on it. And so that immediately adds Montana Resources, which is a primary copper and molybdenum mine, the Black Butte copper mine, which is ramping up towards production, the Hecla exploration project up in Libby is a copper play, and there's a lot of other copper opportunities in Montana. Montana used to be the world's largest producer of copper for significant periods in the early 1900s, late 1800s.
I think that's significant to spend some time on, too, because when we talked with Heather McDowell from Sibanye-Stillwater, she noted, at least brought to my attention, of that the process that produces those critical minerals, like in the Berkeley Pit, is what Russia had found, and they just had palladium laying around because of the processing, so to speak. Once they found out the value of it, they're dumping it on the market. So I think restricting that from Russia's for other reasons is important too. Responsible mining in Montana, $7.3 billion. The economic output on that, more than 18,000 jobs across our state. That is no small industry, and critical as well, as we're talking about a new need for critical materials here to get into and to compete in today's society and tomorrow's society. Matt Vincent is joining us. He's with the Montana Mining Association. It represents the mining industry, policy, jobs, permitting, community engagement as well. And we have a ton more to talk about. Let me just finish up. Do you know anything about Sheep Creek Mine? Skip's previous. And thanks again, Matt, for being here. Do you know anything about Sheep Creek Mine there in the Bitterroot?
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that question. And John Medish, if he were on, and when you do get him on, he can talk a lot more in depth about that.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a list. If you look at the most current list, there's a list of about 53 elements on this critical list.
Okay.
Montana has over 40 of them.
Wow.
And in regards to the rare earth elements, we have got some very rich deposits, zones of deposits within Montana. And one of those zones is that it's called the Alkalic Belt, which is along the Montana Idaho border, which is where Sheep Creek is at, as Skip mentioned. And that's, I think it has been getting a lot of headlines. The owners of that deposit are doing a very good job of promoting it and, you know, getting the word out on it. But let me just tell folks that it's a historically mined area. Mm-hmm. Never mind it very deep, but they did open some adits, which has allowed them to get in and take some surface rock samples that would allow you to get better characterization than you would on a normal surface exploration project. And so that the accurate description of the Sheep Creek mine is not a mine at all. It is the Sheep Creek exploration target. And so they have gone out through, I believe they're in their second notice of intent to collect surface materials from those open adits and some of the outcrops that are on site. And what they've been able to collect from those are some very high grade, as far as rare earth elements are concerned, as well as gallium. They have found some very high grade deposits of those elements on the claims that they're exploring. I do know that they have been working with some researchers to try and figure out some new technology ways of extracting the elements that are targeted in that geology. But it's a long way from becoming a mine. I mean, you have to go through, next would be an exploration license, and you'd have to collect all sorts of background information on the environmental factors in that area. And Skip mentioned it was in a headwaters area close to the West Fork of the Bitterroot, I believe. So you'd have to collect baseline data on all of the environmental issues from vegetation to surface water to groundwater. And then the next step would be you would need to actually drill that with a drill rig to take core samples and get a much better understanding of what that deposit or those deposits look like. And only after you have that information would you be able to infer what the resource is there and determine whether or not or how it would be able to be mined. So that's the Sheep Creek deposit in a nutshell.
Got it. I appreciate that, you know, and there's good news. I mean, those discoveries go a long ways to our overall, I think, picture and knowledge of what we can accomplish being behind the eight ball a little bit here. Montana or American and Montana mining companies, they're getting busy. You know, I think that's a good point, as you note, that's a long ways to go. But we kind of have to shorten up that ramp, don't we, to really try and compete here? What's the likelihood of that?
And that's why as an association, to try and get the most critical elements supplied to our entities in state here that need it. When I say in state, in this case, I'm talking the United States. We're looking at our already permitted operating mines and some of these legacy sites like the Berkeley Pit, the Anaconda smelter site, the old refinery up in Great Falls. East Helena had a smelter. And that's, you and I were talking about that earlier. It's daunting for us to reestablish all of these stops in the supply chain that China has dominated over the last few decades, but we can still see the time in our rearview mirror, so to speak, of when the United States did all of those things. And the difference between then and now is we've got a lot more environmental regulations, and unfortunately we've got a lot more opportunity for environmental
lawfare,
nonprofit organizations that are about a lot more than environmental protection. It's more about litigation when you look at how their business models have evolved, and that's what slows these things down. The average mine to permit in the United States, according to a study from S&P Global done in September of 24, is 29 years. It takes 29 years to get a new mine permitted from early exploration, such as like where the Sheep Creek deposit is at, to actual production of those minerals. And that puts us pretty much, we're next to last on a global mining jurisdiction level and how long it takes to get a permit. We've got to change that.
What's the likelihood of changing that, though? I mean, I don't know if environmental communities, I know that there is a chasm, but it's very small in terms of some of those groups that are recognizing, you know, their agenda, and as you noted, their new business model to raise money on lawfare and things like that, is not accomplishing their goals. Is there any likelihood that you're going to get some reasonable engagement from that community that does an awful lot of crying over whatever and filing lawsuits?
Well, I hope so, Tom. I mean, one thing I will say is they understand the need for this.
I hope.
For these elements. And they have been verbally and even in writing supportive of going back into these legacy sites and trying to find ways to get more out of the already permitted holes that are out there. So I think, you know, they understand it. I know there's a focus, and we agree. They like to focus on the recycling and reuse. I agree. We have got to focus better on that and create this circular supply chain here. But even if we did that and maximized how much we recycled and refined, it doesn't get us away from the dire need for us to permit more significant mining operations for us to meet our critical elements needs. And that's where we got to get on board. And, you know, the way they did that the last time things were dire, which would have been World War II, they used a tool called the Defense Production Act, which just allowed the state, our federal government, to go in, and it was our Defense Department, to mine the deposits out there necessary for them to win the war effort. And we have, you know, I think we have a few of those that took place in Montana. The biggest one that I'm aware of is that Stibnite mine that's right over the Idaho border in Idaho. That is an antimony and gold mine that's trying to get reestablished at that same site. But in World War II, it was used for tungsten and antimony. And at the conclusion of the World War II victory, President Eisenhower made a congressional statement that the tungsten and antimony that came to the U.S. from that mine, which was used to harden munitions and the armors on our tanks and military vehicles, he credited that mine for shortening World War II by at least 1 year and saving the lives of over 1 million American soldiers. That's what we're talking about here. We have got to be able to defend our nation, both the men and women that are fighting for us, so that the people like you and I, Tom, can continue to do the great things we do as a nation for this world of ours.
Matt Vinson is with us here, Executive Director of the Montana Mining Association, mining industries, policies, jobs, permitting, all the engagement. How long have you guys been around, Matt, by the way?
The Montana Mining Association has been around. Initially, we determined, you know, when they passed nonprofit organization laws in Montana in 1972, that was when we were first legally incorporated. But I've been able to find records of the association that go back as early as 1922.
Yeah.
So we've been around for a long time.
Let's move to energy, because that's something that we don't necessarily associate. It takes a tremendous amount of energy. And I repeated what you told me, is that the two of the five largest energy consumers in Montana are mine processors. We've got to budget that in our energy future, and I don't hear an awful lot of talk about it.
No, I brought that up when we were having the panel discussion. I actually brought it up as a question to the panelists in another discussion at the Montana Tech Energy and Critical Materials Summit. And that's that the conversation has been dominated on all of this additional electricity that we are going to need for America to win the artificial intelligence war. And we have already recognized that it's going to take a whole lot more critical elements like copper and silver, all of these things to be able to expand our electrical grid and build these data centers. Gallium, that's why gallium is a real big one on the list. Gallium arsenide is a chip material that is used. But what's not being discussed is, I told you in the rearview mirror, we can still see those days of when the Anaconda smelter was going and when the Columbia Falls aluminum refinery was rolling, East Helena smelter. Those took massive amounts of electricity. And so if we try to, or if it, actually, we're not going to try, we have to do. If we are to reestablish those, that has to be discussed as well. Right now, two of the top five are two major mineral processing facilities in the state, which is Sibanye-Stillwater's metallurgical facility and smelter at Columbus, which I want to make a real quick point there. When you think smelter in 2024, don't, or 2025, don't think Anaconda's massive black stack. Think about what you see when you drive by Columbus, Montana, which is nothing. It's all enclosed in a very neat metal building there that is unbelievably clean. But when it's being smelted and refined in places like China and Russia, it's every bit as bad, if not worse, than what the Anaconda smelter used to be, which we're still cleaning up the remnants of over hundreds of square miles in southwest Montana. So Stillwater is a 50 megawatt per day facility. Montana Resources, which processes copper and molybdenum, is around 50 megawatts per day. And those are two of the five largest electricity users in Montana. If you turn back the clock to when those other ones were operating, I mean, they had to build a hydroelectric dam on the Hungry Horse Reservoir to serve the Columbia Falls aluminum refinery. It was a couple hundred megawatts.
Yeah.
Anaconda smelter, a couple hundred megawatts. If we are to reestablish our processing, smelting, and refining infrastructure to give us that critical minerals independence, it's going to take a lot of electricity, Tom.
Matt, thank you so much for setting the stage for us. We'll be back on this discussion in the near future. Be well. Have yourself a great spring, or pardon me, fall, Matt. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.